The immediate reason for the present talk, as well as for my last talk this month, and perhaps at some point in the future some others, was really our Good Friday service this year. Some of you, of course, have been there, and you know the Good Friday service is based entirely on a text in the Acts of John, which is often referred to as the Hymn of Jesus, and then the reading, the Gospel, which takes place thereafter, is the text of what follows after the Hymn of Jesus. So you really have the two important chapters of the Acts of John, one that is enacted in the service and the other one that is read. Now, this Good Friday service in its present form has been used by us on an annual basis, since Good Friday comes only once a year, so it's on an annual basis, since about 1964 or so. And so I have obviously recited and heard the text there many, many times over. And every time I find some new matter of interest and insight, and I certainly found quite a few this year. So I thought, while the inspiration was still a bit fresh, I would like to communicate some of it to you, and that is what this is all about. But first of all, as always, we need to perhaps build a little bit of context for our discussions, because we have to know at least basically where these texts come from. And the Acts of John, the scripture called the Acts of John, belongs to a particular genre of early Christian literature that actually enjoyed much popularity in early and medieval Christian history, in spite of the suspicions of heresy that surrounded much of the content of these scriptures. Duncan Green Lees, that insightful and accurate translator of many religious materials, describes this genre of literature and its principal individual works in his fine and now unfortunately out of print book, The Gospel of the Gnostics, in the following manner. Mr. Greenlees writes, "In order to appeal to the masses, there is little value in books on straight philosophy. The early Gnostic and Christian propagandists, therefore, circulated what comes close to the idea of historical novels, purporting to narrate the adventures of the first disciples of Jesus. Many of these acts, as they are called, were quite orthodox. They were concerned simply with the story and with popularizing the name of Christianity by heroic adventures among the barbarians. The question of historical accuracy did not arise in the matter. Others were specifically Gnostic." Those are the ones, of course, that we are concerned ourselves with. "Designed to spread abroad a knowledge of the main qualifications for initiation in the mysteries, after some years, the skill of the Gnostic writers made their works far more popular than those of their rivals. The Catholics then pirated them, diluted or excised the so-called heretical or doubtful doctrines, and gave them out as their own work. But the intelligence of these revisers was not quite equal to their task, and they missed much, which to our very good fortune remains for us to study." Now, they weren't smart enough to cut out all the good Gnostic passages, and thereby we still have some of them to study. "The most important," says Mr. Greenlees, "and earliest group of the Gnostic acts were those attributed to one Lucius Carinus, said to be a direct disciple of St. John. because of the coincidence of their special teachings with Manichaeism, they later enjoyed great popularity among the members of that faith, to which an age of later ignorance even came to ascribe their authorship. So they were not Manichaean scriptures, but they were scriptures that the Manichaeans used, even as there is good evidence indicating that the Manichaeans used the Gospel of Thomas, or at least a particular version of the Gospel of Thomas. Might not have been exactly the same one that we have today. And the characteristically Manichaean number 5 appears in this collection, for it consisted of the Acts of 5 of the apostles, Peter, Andrew, John, Thomas, and Philip. Although the Acts of Philip, I think, are not as easily available as the other 4. Now, of the above, the Acts of John interest us particularly here. It was long known that there were these Acts, but as their popularity waned by the time of the Renaissance and the Reformation, and the Orthodox had increasing opportunity to make them vanish from sight, we encountered them less and less. The 19th century, with its increasing interest in ancient heterodox literature, brought a number of significant portions of the Acts of John to light. Between 1847 and 1897, several fairly long fragments of the Acts of John were discovered and published, the longest being a 14th century manuscript discovered in Vienna. And these are always sort of mysterious. You know, for hundreds of years, these scriptures sit somewhere. They're obviously there. People see them, even in many cases, well, not in the case of Nag Hammadi, because they were under the sand, but nobody looks at them, and all of a sudden, lo, here it is. Look what we had before us all this time. that is how it happened with these. While the authorship of all 5 Acts, Peter, Andrew, John, Thomas, and Philip, is ascribed to Lucius Carinus, their author's authority is most clearly evident in the Acts of John, inasmuch as Lucius was generally regarded as a personal disciple of John, the author of the 4th Gospel. According to tradition, of course, John is also the author of the book of Revelation and Jesus his beloved disciple, also sometimes known as John the Beloved, John the Evangelist, John of Patmos, because that is where he is supposed to have written the book of Revelations. Even Lucius's style of writing seems to resemble that of St. John. In those instances where we are dealing with his original intact style, it resembles closely that of St. John's Gospel, as several scholars have remarked. The chronology of the possible relationship of Lucius and St. John is quite credible also, and there I also very briefly will give you Greenleaf's view, which I think is very reasonable. Greenleaf writes, "I find no sort of difficulty in believing that the old saint," meaning St. John, "who died about A.D. 95, could have had then a disciple aged 20, who could have written these Acts when in the full prime of maturity, about 55, by which time it would have been A.D. 130. The style is not that of a young man, but of one experienced in much suffering from the world after deep contemplation of the real meaning of the Christian revelation, one who after long struggles to overcome the flesh has at last attained the victory. There is nothing in these Acts which would go against their having been written in or near Ephesus, where St. John lived and died. There are many signs that the first writing was very early." Ephesus, of course, in Greece, you know, is an ancient and very famous place where the great worship of the goddess Diana existed for many times. It was even a common exclamation of the old Greeks when they had nothing else to say, which probably was seldom, knowing the Greeks, who always have something to say, whether it's useful or not. Great is the Diana of the Ephesians. And according to tradition, that is the place where the Virgin Mary, whom from the cross her son entrusted to John the Beloved, went, and St. John took care of her, and that is where she died. The dormition of the Theotokos occurred, as the Greeks call it, or from whence, according to ancient belief, she subsequently was assumed into heaven. All of that took place in Ephesus. Now, so much then at this point about the Acts themselves. Now, as to their specific content, and one particular teaching mentioned in them tonight. No doubt it would be profitable, but also perhaps a tiny bit tedious for me to go through just line by line at least the two chapters that we use and interpret every one, but I have chosen to adopt a little different and perhaps more lively method. The liveliness shall be judged as to how many of you stay awake. Before coffee, yeah, you know. In the manuscript of the Acts of John, of the so-called Vienna copy, and in other copies, some of which are in the original Greek, we have the two chapters which are closely joined together and follow upon each other. These are the so-called Hymn of Jesus, also sometimes called the Dance of Jesus, and the Vision of John of the Mystery of the Cross. You are familiar with both of them, for many of you, from the Good Friday service. The Hymn of Jesus is the one that we will deal with primarily today, but you may also recall the basic format of the subsequent chapter, when John the Beloved, at the time of the crucifixion, absents himself from all that is going on in Jerusalem and goes up into the mountains, into the hills, into a cave, in fact, and there at the mouth of the cave, Jesus appears to him and speaks to him. And not only speaks to him, but also shows him a number of outstanding visions. And then that the dialogue that takes place, or primarily the monologue delivered by Jesus to John, comprises that particular chapter. Part is also corroborated, incidentally, by similar acts of Peter, the similar acts of Peter and Andrew, in spite of the mutilations that these suffered at the hands of the so-called Orthodox. So what I mean by this is that there are passages in the Acts of John which are duplicated or described in very similar terms in the other two, in the Acts of Peter and in the Acts of Andrew. One of the major manuscripts has an introductory prefix to the first chapter, which describes the hymn and dance of Jesus as follows: the hymn of the Lord, which he sang in secret to the holy apostles, his disciples. And then it says, the hymn is not put in the canon because of those who think according to themselves and not according to the spirit and truth of God, and who know not that it is written. And that's a quotation: it is good to hide the king's sacrament, but it is honorable to reveal God's works. So what this really says is that the Orthodox think according to their human understanding and not according to a higher understanding, and that's why they have removed these particular works from the canon, you know. Canon just means book in Greek. So the canon were was the book or the aggregate of books which were considered official. But then there is this interesting quotation, and it's not only interesting because of its text, but because we don't know where it comes from. They are quoting another scripture, possibly another gospel, that is no longer available. And this is the one that says, it is good to hide the king's sacrament, but it is honorable to reveal God's works. So, thereby perhaps meaning, the king possibly also being God, there are some things, mysteries, sacraments, that one may legitimately conceal from people's eyes. Not everything is to be put out there for everybody. But on the other hand, there are others which are called here God's works, and this would qualify, this should be made available, and yet people have hidden it away. Now, lest somebody may think that this is some kind of a sort of Gnostic mystery-mongering or early conspiracy theory, you must remember that the Gnostics had no access to Montana. But no other than what would seem to be an unlikely source, Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, has gone on record in his statements, not in the Quran, but in the Hadith, as saying that the Christians, something to the effect that the trouble with the Christians is that they had hidden other important gospels of Jesus, and they have hidden them away, and the ones that they have, doctored up. So Muhammad knew about other gospels, for which he probably did not necessarily need to be a prophet, because information about such things was probably still freely circulating in his time. So these things are fairly well attested. In the first chapter, we have, of course, the description of the strange and wondrous events that occur sometimes prior to Jesus' arrest, trial, and crucifixion, according to the traditional chronology, sometime after the Last Supper, late on Maundy Thursday, or in the very early hours of Good Friday. Of course, we need to remember that this traditional chronology of the days of the Easter story is mythological and dramatized. It may have taken more days, it may have taken less. This is just the way it comes down to us in the Easter story of Holy Week. The apparent intent of the story of the hymn of Jesus, at least from my own point of view, and at my own point of view, I might say, at which I arrived after much reflection over many years, as I just mentioned, it's been since 1960, that we have performed the hymn of Jesus every Good Friday, so I had a lot of time to reflect over it in that context. I arrived at this over many years, and my view of it is the following, namely that this is the intent of the story. Jesus knows that the apostles will suffer an enormous shock when he is taken away and crucified. And he knows that, he has foreknowledge that that is going to happen to him. And thus he wishes to prepare them for this horrendous experience. I don't think we need to elaborate on that, but you know, just imagine a group of people who have put all their trust in this figure, who as several of our other Gnostic scriptures make them say, our Lord, we have left father and mother, our goods and our fields, the whole world, and followed you. You know, they have given their life over to this person, and now he is going to be taken away from them. He is going to be tried in public in a very ignominious manner and executed as a criminal. That is not a, a, a very pleasant experience, and it is not an experience that is calculated to maintain the faith and good spirits of these people. So since he knows that, he wants to prepare them for this experience. The preparation, however, is not a rational and prosaic one, such as we might expect within an Orthodox context. Thinking retrospectively from the theology of the mainstream Christian bodies, or many of the mainstream Christian bodies today, Jesus would say something like this: "Well, I have to get crucified in order to save the world, boys. I hope that you will understand that. You know, you just have to understand that I can't take away the sins of the world unless I die on the cross. So simmer down and behave yourselves while this is going on. And then afterwards everything is going to be all right anyway." There are the apostles saying, "Oh, gee, Lord, can't you figure out a better way than that?" You know, something of that sort. Now, of course, I am making fun of that. But the reason I do that is because this would be a sort of prosaic, rationalistic explanation. Now, it wouldn't be rational or rationalistic in terms of a materialistic scientist, but it is rationalistic within a religious concept, because you say, this has to be done for this reason, you know, very kind of linear situation. And that is supposed to explain. But of course that is not by any means what he is doing here. A rationalistic explanation of that sort doesn't really help. So the preparation is of a different nature. It is of a mystical nature. Jesus wants his disciples to enter an altered state of consciousness, to use a rather trite term for it, wherein they might properly apprehend what is about to happen from an other than ordinary plane of consciousness. The great translator and exegete G.R.S. Mead, George Robert Stowe Mead, incidentally, was his name, died in 1933, in his fine small book entitled The Hymn of Jesus, put forth a view which has some merit, but which I don't agree with. Neither does Greenleaf agree with it. Mead seemed to think that the apparent dialogue in the Hymn of Jesus, which contains such passages as, "I will be saved and I will save," you know, "I will to be freed and I will free," "I would be wounded and I would wound," and so forth, that this denotes a back and forth dialogue, and that it comprises an initiation discourse. Something like, let's say, the eighth reveals the ninth, although there isn't all that much dialogue there either, except some question. So that this is said by an initiator and an initiate to each other. Greenleaf disagrees, and I agree with Greenleaf's disagreement. The speaker, it seems, throughout the text is Christ himself. He says it all. The disciples are limited to the circular dance and the repeating of Amen, which is an exclamation of assent. Now, what does this mean? By way of the dance and the rhythmic repetition, and perhaps by other additional means to which we are not privy, natural or supernatural, the disciples are transported into an extraordinary state of consciousness. Is this so unusual? No. What do the Sufis do, for instance? And after all, you know, the Sufis may have gained, pardon the pun, their sophistication from similar sources, because they lived in the same area. I don't think that it all just started with Mulana Rumi, Jalaluddin Rumi, hanging on to a pillar in some place and starting to sort of gyrate around this pillar and then going into a kind of a trance and then saying, aha, we can do this by dancing. Because there is a long precedent for this sort of thing. Obviously, again, this is nothing so extraordinary. The purpose of the dance is to alter the consciousness, to change the mental state of the apostles. In this state of consciousness, they are capable of apprehending the extraordinary truths their teacher utters to them, which do not make rational sense when heard or said in an ordinary state of consciousness. The divine teacher first calls on the Most High, glory to thee, Father, glory to thee, Word, glory to thee, Grace, glory to thee, Spirit, Holy One, glory to thy glory. And then the assembled disciples answer, Amen. This is the initial invocation, and while I'm not going to go through the scripture line by line, I think this one is particularly important. Incidentally, if any of you have heard the beautiful musical rendition of the Hymn of Jesus composed by Gustav Holst, that is sort of the most important dramatic beginning, because Holst has some Gregorian, very soft, very medieval kind of Gregorian chants in the beginning. Pange lingua gloriosi, I think, is one of them, Vexilla Regis. And so these go on for a while, and then all of a sudden, with full force of orchestra and choir, you know, breaks into that melody, glory to thee, Father, glory to thee, Word. You know, it's sort of the lightning flash of gnosis into the ordinary situation. And so this is of great importance, and I will just briefly dwell on it, however. Because I think we need to look at this from a contemporary point of view. If there is no Father, no Logos, no Holy Spirit to whom we aspire, then what are we doing? This is the trouble with so much contemporary so-called spirituality. You know, we don't even dare to call it religion, spirituality. Again, there are reasons for it. A lot of people have been hurt by religion, present company probably totally included, because we live in a secular world where much thinking is essentially, whether it is admitted or not, atheistic. We want spirituality, we want to meditate, we want to do spiritual exercises, but we want to do these without the context of a God. To be sure, there are valid existential reasons for this attitude. Who wants to meditate on Jehovah? Well, if somebody does, I won't stop him, but I certainly won't join him. Or even who wants to meditate on an angry Christ, the terrible judge of the quick and the dead, who is really no more or less than the judgmental creation of theologians who disregarded the fact that he had preached love rather than judgment. So a lot of false conditioning exists. People resent the monotheistic God. Many of them resent the figure of Christ, because they have been presented with warped images and concepts concerning these persons. But from my point of view, and I think from Gnostic point of view generally, one might say, the God that these people don't want to have anything to do with, and the Christ from whom they recoil, is not our God and is not our Christ. Assuredly, Jehovah and the corrupted image of Christ are not the only images of divinity of whom we can avail ourselves. Is the only choice between these false deities on the one hand and mere nothing on the other? I really hardly think so. And so the Gnostic vision of the true God above Jehovah, the God beyond God, can supply that. Only cowards run away from the ultimate reality while inwardly whining about the injuries they have suffered at the hands of the false gods of their childhood. This is not a profitable undertaking. One has to, like any shadow situation from a psychological point of view, eventually one has to face these and sort of recognize them for what they are. If they were illusory, if they were injurious, if they were inadequate, one has to come that, recognize that, and go right through them to the truth, instead of darting off to this side, darting off to that side, ending up with Kali, ending up with Ishtar, ending up with Avalokiteshvara, or whatever. Not that these others don't have a certain validity to them, although I must say that Goddess Kali would please me a lot better if she just didn't have that immense red tongue hanging out right sort of right down to their navel. I have a hard time viewing her in any other context but the grandmother of all vampires, whom, of course, the vampires they generally respect, so grandma must be okay too. But eventually we have to get through these things and not dart off in various directions. Now, let's say this needs to be kept in mind. The seeking for God is preferable to and superior to the seeking of any kind of quiet mind or anything else. Why? Because, let's say, if meditations and things of that sort, which incidentally can be quite helpful, are practiced, one needs to ask oneself, to what end are they practiced? And the only acceptable answer is that they ought to be practiced so that one may thereby facilitate one's closeness to the divine. If they are practiced for other ends, these ends are inferior ends, and they will probably land one in trouble. One should not forget, for instance, that in Japan, for instance, and I have enormous respect for Japan, I have far more respect for Japan than for any other nation or culture in Asia, but it is a matter of historical record that the meditation methods coming from Buddhism, particularly from Zen Buddhism, have been used for centuries for the purposes of more efficient warfare by the samurai, right down to the time of the kamikaze and others in World War II. You know. When something is used for the purpose to make you a better warrior, instead of bringing you closer to God, there's something wrong. Which shows that the practice in itself, without a proper objective, isn't all that great and wonderful, because it can mislead as well. The objective is the important. All right, enough of that now. For which reason, let's say, important exercises such as the hymn of Jesus are always prefaced by an invocation of the object of the exercise, such as glory to the Father, glory to the Word, glory to the Holy Spirit. They are not prefaced by an invocation to the great nondescript nothing, you know. Now, since we shall have more on the Acts of John at another talk, we shall concentrate on the key issue, what I think is the key issue, as characterized by a key sentence which occurs in the hymn of Jesus and which appears as the key of the entire text. The sentence is, and we will hear it again, "Hadst thou known how to suffer, thou wouldst have been able not to suffer. Then know how to suffer, and thou wilt be able not to suffer. What thou knowest not, I myself shall teach thee." This sentence occurs within the context of two short paragraphs, of which this is the heart and essence. So I think it would be useful to hear the two paragraphs themselves. Here they are. Now respond to my dancing. See thyself in me as I speak, and seeing what I do, keep silence on my mysteries. He who dances understands what I am doing, for thine is the passion of this man, man in capital, this is the Anthropos, the cosmic man, which I am about to suffer. For thou couldst not wholly realize what I suffer, had not I, a word, a logos, come to thee from the Father. Seeing what I suffer, thou hast seen me as suffering, and seeing thou didst not stand firm, but wast altogether moved, or as one translation have it, thou wert being shaken to grow wise. What a nice phrase. Sometimes we have to be shaken to grow wise. Hadst thou known how to suffer, thou wouldst have been able not to suffer. Then know how to suffer, and thou wilt be able not to suffer. What thou knowest not, I myself shall teach thee. And now comes a sort of the reassuring second paragraph. Thou hast me as a couch, rest thou upon me. Who am I? Thou shalt know when I go away. What I now seem that I am not, but what I am thou shalt see as soon as thou comest, which really means to me. I am thy God, not the betrayers. I will to be harmonized with holy souls. Know thou therefore in me the word of wisdom. Remember what we said before. Jesus wants to prepare the disciples for the catastrophe that is about to befall him. So he tells them, see that what is happening to me, in a manner not as readily discerned, but just as really, is also happening to you. You are also crucified. You are also tortured. You also die, because such experiences are part of your existence. They don't have to come and take you before the Sanhedrin, and take you before Pilate, and then march you through the streets and put you on a cross. Just by being here, you are experiencing these things. Okay? But now, when you are dancing with me, that we are faced with a universal tragedy. The state of consciousness that I have put you in allows you to catch an intimation that this is not just an individual situation that pertains to me, but that it is a universal situation. It goes on everywhere. And it is a universal tragedy, which is experienced by the Logos of God as much as by every human being. In fact, what he says is that he came to show his disciples his suffering and thus wake them up to their own suffering and its meaning. For thou couldst not wholly realize what I suffer, had not I, the Logos, come to thee from the Father. And seeing what I suffer, thou hast seen me as suffering, and seeing thou hast not remained unmoved, but wert altogether being shaken to be wise. So, you know, what do we have there? You could not have received this truth unless these circumstances had come together, that the Logos of God came down and went through this experience, and in so doing you were moved, you were shaken up to recognize what is going on and become wise. See, we go along in life and suffer a good deal. That is undeniable. And we watch others suffer, not only humans, but even animals, all sorts of beings. Yet we don't take essential cognizance of this. To the extent that we do, we quickly rationalize it. The common rationalization of faith in Christian history has been, and Jewish history too for that matter, Islamic history too, it is God's will. But you know that wears thin after a while. Also one comes to think, well, either, you know, we have been through all of these things and others have, you know, there was the rabbi some few years ago who wrote a book about why terrible things happen to good people or why bad things happen to good people. And he also pretty much came to the somewhat Gnostic conclusions, the most uncompromising version of which is, you know, either God is not good, and then he doesn't will these things, or if he wills these things, then he cannot be good. If his will is not involved in it, then on the other hand, he is not omnipotent. So there are very strange questions that arise here. So with a lot of people now, as well as I think in those times, the issue that all of this suffering is God's will just didn't really wash, to put it in colloquial terms. Now in come the influences from the East, particularly since sort of the latter quarter of the 19th century, they are still with us, and here is the next big explanation. It is karma, you know. All right. Up to a degree, if one really immerses oneself in that really essentially very causalistic, very reductionistic notion of karma, because that's what it is, you might even convince yourself that the nasty things, the terrible suffering that happened to people somehow are a matter of some kind of karmic debt. Of course, to it has to be added the whole reincarnational situation, because otherwise it doesn't make any sense. But what about everything else that suffers? This has bothered some very fine people who were very great advocates of karma. Dr. Annie Besant, for instance, a very great and wonderful woman whom I greatly admired. I knew people who were there when she was on her deathbed. You know, he said this was the one thing that she kept agonizing over at the time that she died and for some time before. Why do all the poor animals suffer? Mm-hmm. She could rationalize it out for people, but she couldn't for the animals. And it shows that the tight doctrine with karma there had a hole, and she saw it. She didn't like it. And it has many holes, because individually you can sort of deal with it. All right, well, maybe I have been a bigger rascal even in some past lives than I am now. And so various things come down on me. After all, this is possible. None of us are that sure of the exalted virtue of our character, even in this lifetime. So even less so for a past lifetime. But, you know, there are other suffering creatures. And what then, however, of extraordinary and collective suffering? What of entire large aggregates of people? What of the Holocaust? What of the Gulag archipelago? What of the Chinese Gulag? What of the killing fields of Cambodia, you know? Is all this karma? Because now it's not individual. Now you are dealing with something very, very vast. and including little children and including sick people, you know, all kinds of things, doesn't wash once again. Well, then we have others, of course. A very popular one, when something bad happens to us and so forth, it's somebody else's fault. Generally, it's their fault, you know. They make me suffer. Good old scapegoat principle. Whoever, it doesn't make them. Jews, Masons, the Illuminati. With the feminists, of course, it's all the fault of men. Maybe with somebody else, it's all the fault of women. Whoever, you know, just pick somebody. Illegal immigrants, legal immigrants, sheriffs, you know, U.S. government, militia, it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault. Everything is someone else's fault. Doesn't work. Mm. And worst of all, it is our fault. In some manner or the other, we have sinned, clear back to Adam and Eve, and in the New Age, of course, we have not been thinking right. We have allowed negativity to enter. You know, once again, it has to be pronounced in the proper way to be effective. You know, or we haven't eaten right. We haven't exercised enough, and all of that. But it doesn't really work. And it particularly doesn't work when a dramatic, super dramatic, supernatural situation comes to someone, as apparently it came to the apostles and the disciples. Here is God's Logos, there, who said of himself, and they believed it, they even believed it if he hadn't said it, that he was the truth and the way. This was the way for them to get to God. When this person suffers, not even just necessarily on the wooden cross, but just by being here. So here we see that the mystery is here, but also that the mystery can be solved, but not by these kinds of explanations. Not by putting everything down to God's will or to karma or blaming it on someone else, or blaming it on ourselves. We can't say in this case that it is God's will, because this is the Son of God. So does he will this for himself? Not really. Is it his karma? Nonsense. He hasn't got any. Is it someone else's fault? Well, this has been tried. The Jews killed him. And then others, just as stupidly, come in and trying to deflect the blame from the Jews, trying to blame it on the Romans. After all, they aren't around anymore, so it's not going to be such a big deal if you blame it on the Romans. You know, but blaming somebody else all the time. But these are actors in the great drama, Jews, Romans. Is it his fault? Well, it's certainly not, because he has no fault. So where does his suffering come from? From the situation, from being here, from existence. And here is, I think, the beginning of the secret that everyone is seeking, but virtually no one finds. Let me sort of backtrack a little. Indicate some statements, truths, maybe half-truths, that I have come across repeatedly in my life. It's a well-known statement, and that in itself is not without merit, that suffering can be somehow meaningful. That suffering is not an unmitigated evil, but that in some way it can lead to something good. It is also a very common and very time-honored practice in Christendom, for instance, that when people are greatly suffering, let's say, very ill and have a lot of pain, various other things, that one practice that they engage in, have engaged in over the ages, is to connect their suffering somehow with that of the Savior, and saying that, look how he suffered, how much more he has suffered, offer your suffering to that same end, and thereby your suffering becomes transformed or sanctified. And I have spoken to a fair number of people who have experienced a great deal of relief in their misery by doing that. Yet somehow it always seemed to me that there was something wrong with it. I never could quite accept it. Now I think we can discover something here that will in part justify that, in part show that up as being only a part truth, because there is of course something again missing. What this situation is really moving toward is well expressed in a cognate passage of another of the Acts of Andrew. This is what is said in the Acts of Andrew, again attributed to Jesus. Feel with me in your suffering, that you may take knowledge of what I suffer, and so escape suffering. Now, I think we are slowly getting somewhere, although it may take a little sinking in, so to say. Let's say Buddhism very correctly recognizes the universality of suffering and teaches that by liberating enlightenment we will come to the end of suffering. This is the cardinal teaching of the Buddha. The Christian tradition, on the other hand, goes in a sense farther and says that suffering itself is valuable in a mysterious way. The value of suffering, like other truths, has become, however, muddled after the loss of gnosis in Christendom. It led at best to the idea that we should identify with Christ in our suffering, as I mentioned before, offer up our own suffering along with his so much greater suffering. There is a certain amount of gnosis in this idea, but there is also a certain important Gnostic element lacking. And what might that be? It is simply this, that we must recognize that albeit on a lesser level of consciousness, this is hard to even pronounce, we are the same as he. He comes from the true God to help us, even as we came from the same true God long ago to fulfill some now obscure but similar purpose. You see, this is the opposite extreme of this kind of low-level, secularized, kind of Unitarian, contemporary Unitarian view, that he is just another human. Therefore, we are the same as he. No. The Gnostic is on the opposite end of the story, shall we say. In all humility and in all reverence and without ever wishing to be sacrilegious, we are the same as he because we are also divine. That is why. But of course, we don't know that we are divine. He knows that he is divine. He knows and we don't know. And that is why we go to him for gnosis, so that we might know also. When you look at many of the creation myths, emanation myths of the Gnostic scriptures, perhaps even more when you look at the Manichaean myth, you always see a similar motif repeating itself. Something, someone comes forth from the Supreme Source, goes down into the lesser worlds for some purpose and is lost. And another one comes forth to find the lost one and becomes himself lost. And then sometimes yet another one comes to find all of these and is lost again. Until finally, when these waves have gone forth, somebody comes who is no longer lost and who finds. And such a one in the Christian mythos is the Christ. But of course the Gnostics recognized that there were others before him, and there was even one after him, not equal in stature, but very, very similar in his mission, Mani, the prophet, who again did not lose sight of who he was. What do we have here? We have this ongoing process of discovering each other for the purpose of waking up each other and accomplishing the return. As in our relationship to the messenger, in this case to Jesus, he is a logos of God and we are minor logoi of God. But we have forgotten who we are. There is even a Buddhist saying, and of course Buddhism is far less theistic, far less personalized than the Christian or the Gnostic mythos, that the principal difference between a Buddha and someone who is not a Buddha is that the Buddha knows that he is the Buddha. The others don't. That makes all the difference. Because of course this is not just some kind of a trivial recognition of identity, like you were adopted or something like that and you don't know the name of your parents, and then you have known people like that, spend a great deal of their lives and a lot of money running around obsessively trying to find out, and now they find out that they are not a Smith but a Johnson. Big deal, you know. It's not that kind of a finding out of an identity. It's a finding out of your own essence, of something unbelievably wonderful and powerful, something so incredible, so mind-boggling, so unimaginable, that you could never find it in any book. You could not imagine it, you could not dream it. If somebody told you, you would have called them a liar and chased them out of your house. All of a sudden, as the result of the help, to a major extent, that you receive from one of the helpers come from above, you know who you are. The words do not suffice to approach this sort of thing, and yet it is an incredible and overwhelming reality. He can say, "See thyself in me who speaks. See thyself in me as I speak." And further, "Thine is this suffering of the man, the passion of the man. The man is the Anthropos, the cosmic man, which I am about to suffer." It's a complex little sentence, you see? Because it means that he and we are portions of the heavenly man, the Anthropos, the Adam Kadmon, and it is this collective heavenly man who suffers in us, but after a different fashion. We are the lost sheep. Come from the white flock of heaven, scattered sparks, flown far away from the vast holy fire, drops fallen from the great cloud of the heavenly waters. Such are just some of the many metaphors trying to describe this situation. While we are separated from our origins, we suffer. Not because we have sinned, not because we have created the suffering karma, and indeed for no other cause, but because we are here rather than there. This is the cause of suffering. This is the nature of suffering. But if we can suffer as our example suffers, then things will change. Why? because probably old Carl Jung up there would say, because we are now suffering in full consciousness. We are undergoing what we have been undergoing for timeless aeons. We are undergoing the same thing. Because, you know, even if you go a lot into reincarnation, that essentially is still pretty much the same. You are born, you yell a lot, you make your parents miserable for a few years in that fashion. Later on, you make him miserable in another fashion. And then you run around and try to have sex with as many as possible or whatever goes on. You know, all kinds of excitement. You feel kind of alive and all of that. And then if you haven't been eaten by saber-toothed tigers, by lions, you haven't been run down by cars, you haven't got AIDS and things like that, then maybe you get older, and the suffering takes another form. And eventually you sort of shuffle around like Shakespeare in the Seven Ages of Man, you know, in the last one, sans, what is it, sans hair, sans teeth, sans everything, you know. When you lean shank in your increasingly wide trousers, and so forth, if you happen to wear trousers. So even if reincarnation is taken into account, it's always the same, you know. Whether you were in Atlantis or whether you were in medieval Europe or whether you were in ancient Egypt or here, the pattern was always pretty much the same. Sometimes you got knocked off earlier in life, sometimes later, but you know, the pattern is there. And what is this? Unconsciousness. If I can just fight off this particular virus, you know? If I can just kick this lion in the nose so he's going to go away, and after having moderately eaten me, he's not going to eat me completely, then everything is going to be all right. If I can just drag out my life another 5 years, another 10 years, another 7 years, one thing or the other, just enough to make a little more money, buy another car, and so forth. Unconsciousness. It's suffering without awareness of anything. Without awareness of where the suffering comes from, or whether it leads to anything. Just unconsciousness. Unconsciousness is unconsciousness. But when something comes and wakes you up and says, look, what you are undergoing is universal. Everybody is undergoing it. And why is that? Because by undergoing it, you are going to wake up. And then your consciousness eventually will be such that you won't have to undergo it anymore. Your consciousness will be different. Indeed, it will be in a different aeon, in a different existential realm, where these things don't exist anymore. We don't need to envision these things as some kind of a space travel in geographical or space distance. It's not a matter of if we learned how to suffer and we have taken the teaching of the Logos to heart, we are going to get into a big rocket ship or a big flying saucer, and then we are going to be transported to Alpha Centauri where there is no suffering. These are reductionistic, childish ways of envisioning the situation. But there is a movement into an other realm of being. From the realm of unconsciousness into the realm of consciousness. From the place where you don't know anything to the place where you know a lot. And that makes a great deal of difference. And that also removes the kind of limitation, the kind of suffering that you labor under here. If we can therefore be shaken up to wisdom in this regard, then that change can occur. And this change can occur in various ways. Buddha had a particular way of operating with it within his own context. I must admit that. That's probably the only one, I think, who has been very, very effective with it in another place and in another dispensation. But the way of the Christian image has been the potential of awakening to the cause of suffering, to conscious suffering, and thereby the overcoming of suffering by contemplating this incredible mystery of the Logos of the Son of God undergoing this. And that is what he reminds us here. But it was misunderstood. Instead of that, you have the blood-dripping, suffering Christ everywhere. Even that crozier cross that Pope John Paul inherited from, I think originally from Pope Paul VI, the Christ on it looks like a desiccated bug. I really, that's why I didn't become Pope, because I just couldn't bear wandering around carrying a cross like that. I would get rid of it very soon. I put on it a nice, beautiful one, strong, Adonis-like looking Christ hanging among the grapes, like Dionysius. The whole the understanding is still there that somehow this suffering is valuable, but it has been forgotten why it is valuable. It is not valuable because by way of that suffering, just in itself and of itself, the world and the people in it and souls in it are redeemed. But because if it is contemplated in the proper manner, the souls within it can come to certain very, very important, very fundamental recognition, which bring gnosis. That is the issue. How does he say in the next chapter of the Acts of John, and we will be done with that fairly soon. Thou hearest of me suffering, yet have I not suffered. Not suffering, yet have I suffered. Pierced, yet was I not smitten. Hanged, but was not hanged. Blood flowing from me, yet it did not flow. And in a word, what they say of me, these things I did not have. Well, what they do not say, those have I suffered. Now will I shadow forth for thee what they are, for I know that thou wilt understand. So already at that time, when this was written, there was an understanding that was askew, a concentrating on those aspects which were not important. And what will he shadow forth for our gnosis? Here are again his words, just a few sentences earlier. I'll give you the context in a minute. For know that I am wholly with the Father, and the Father with me. And this is the same one in context. Pay no heed then to the many. I think some of us still remember the person, our friend, reading it last Friday, a week ago. And think little of those outside the mystery, for know that I am wholly with the Father and the Father with me. Therefore, I have suffered nothing of what they are going to say about me, nay, even that suffering which I showed thee and the rest while dancing, I will to be called a mystery. For what thou seest, this have I shown thee, but what I am, that I alone know, no other. Let me then keep what is mine, and see what is thine through me. Very important sentence right there. But see me truly, not what I even said I am, but what thou, being akin to me, canst realize. Being akin to him. the disciples could realize who they were, and thus they could live through the terrible times when their master and liberator was taken from them, at least seemingly, he was hung up on a wood, bleeding and agonizing and finally dying and then dead. The mystery thus lessens, but it is perhaps still present to some degree. How could we be really kin to him? How could we see ourselves in him who spoke to us in this manner? How? How? This identification, this kinship is not, cannot be one of words, not one of ideas and concepts. It belongs to an exalted consciousness, an ecstasy, which the disciples experienced in the dance. Speaking and writing about these matters does not disclose their essential meaning. It never has, and it never will. That, incidentally, is true in many different traditions. There is, as I'm sure all of you know, a very, very famous portion of the vast epic, the Mahabharata, the great Bharata war, which is called the Divine Song or the Bhagavad Gita, because that is the portion where the deity manifests by Krishna, disguised as the charioteer of Prince Arjuna, appears and makes these revelations to Arjuna, and that the story of that dialogue basically is the Bhagavad Gita. It starts out with a very puzzling passage, very distasteful to the pacifists. Even Gandhi tried to interpret it in totally metaphorical terms. But there is a meaning in it that is, I think, usually not recognized by anyone. And that's the part when they ride out in the war chariot to the battlefield, as some of you may remember, and out there arrayed are all the enemies who are all relatives of Krishna. They are all cousins and uncles and grandfathers and whatnot. And he looks and he trembles and he says, "No, I can't do this. I can't kill these people. They are my relatives." And he's about to lay the weapon down. And then Krishna shows him, he doesn't just tell him, he shows him, it's quite evident from the words, that these people whom he doesn't want to touch are in reality, in the mind of God, in the mind of Krishna, already all dead. He says, "You won't do it, they are dead already." And then he bows down, he says, "Well, what can I do? I'm going to go ahead." And things like that go on really throughout the Bhagavad Gita. And the issue is that these matters concern experience, unusual experience. Mm-hmm. And that is what Jesus is doing with the disciples here. He shows them the union of the opposites. He says, "I am this and I am that. I am that and I am this." He says it all about himself, you know, all the various opposites that are there. It all indicates that they are in a realm of mind now where they're capable of appreciating that He is the food and he is the eater, which is a term, for instance, that occurs in, I think, in one of the Upanishads. I've read it in one of them. But this doesn't work in words. It does not pertain to the level of concepts and precepts. It is something that has to be realized. So when they are there, they can see that whatever the Jews and the Romans or whoever are going to do to him, it couldn't matter less. That is not what is important. The important thing is that he has awakened them to their own condition and by way of their own condition, by seeing that in a mystical way what is happening to him at a higher level is also what has been happening to them, they are lifted up to the same kind of consciousness where he is. And therefore, they are somewhere else already. And when they lay their bodies aside, to that something else they will go. It is an exercise in consciousness. It is a divine trick whereby they are shaken out of their ordinary way of perceiving things, and now they perceive them in a different way. Just like Krishna at that moment could see that this has already all happened. He is not even going to participate in it. And later on, when Krishna shows himself as the universal being, then Arjuna is almost completely devastated. He can't stand it, and he begs Krishna to come back to his human form, because he cannot any longer contemplate this unbelievable wealth of images that the divine is. Mm-hmm. It's a different state of mind. It's a different place. But he promised that he will bestow the kind of changed, exalted consciousness wherein the full realization of our identity with him and through him with the ultimate, with the Father, will be disclosed. What I now seem, that I am not. But what I am, thou shalt see as soon as thou comest. Comest where? Comest to my consciousness. Comest to the place where I am. That is the coming. Is an elevation of consciousness to where he is, a mystical becoming one with him. As we help each other, so we are helped. When we come to see that that goes on also in ourselves, when our suffering knows itself as being related to that, indeed as being part of his suffering, and he is known as ours, then the work is done. And then the seeds of light are gathered from the sea of forgetfulness. I know that this is an extremely difficult and extremely tricky subject. If it weren't, I would have come upon it the first time I read it, or the first time we read it in a service. I don't profess that now I can really convey, that I can really put it across. But I think that I might have been able to indicate it, that at least to some of you, something will begin to stir there about the kind of incredible, powerful, liberating truth that is present in this. And as that seed sort of works in us, it will grow further, and it will allow us to overcome this suffering world by way of its own greatest difficulty, its own great curse, which is the pain and the suffering and the limitation of all beings. The flaw, the curse, will be overcome by itself. And it seems to me that there is irrefutable evidence that someone has shown this to us long ago. And we may be extremely grateful that the documentation of that statement is still with us. But remember, words, concepts, ideas, thoughts are not salvific. They don't liberate. The reality to which they point is the only thing that liberates. So may we proceed to that to which they point in our own way and in God's good time. Thanks.